passwordless is the future.
JavaScript isn't fun, that's for sure.
I'll drop a hot grenade right here. My ideal world is...
Welcome back to another episode of Backend Banter, the show about backend engineering and careers. Today, I'm joined by Dev Agarwal. Am I saying that right?
Almost.
Okay, Dev, how do I say
Agarwal.
It?
Agarwal.
Agarwal, okay.
The last name is difficult. You don't have, don't worry about it.
So, is your first name really Dev?
It is, fortunately, or I guess coincidentally. Like, obviously, my mom wasn't thinking that I was going to be a software developer or a developer at all, really.
That's a shame.
It has a different meaning in our language, but coincidentally, I turned out to be interested in software development, and my name is Dev. And then I got into DevRel.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you're a DevRel at Clerk, and your first name is Dev. For a long time, so like we've chatted on Twitter several times. We have a bunch of mutual friends on Twitter, and for a long time, I thought it was just like, I'm a dev. And so it was like a title before your name. And then I slowly came to realize, wait, maybe this is like actually his name.
Yeah, I've been trying to find ways to fix that. Like, my name is actually pronounced Dave, like not Dev, but like in my native language. But everyone calls me Dev anyway. So I've just grown to it at this point. But I was thinking at some point that I should change it to. Yeah. I was thinking of changing it to like Dave on Twitter or something, but there are also way too many Daves.
No. It's actually perfect. Okay, cool. So yeah, currently you're a DevRel at Clerk, a company that does like auth as a service, basically. And I've always wondered, as a DevRel, what is it about actually writing code that scares you so much?
You know, it's when some part of your code is expecting some other part of your code to be in a different version, but you don't know about it, and then you have no idea why it's failing, and then you have to reinstall everything and just fix one little version mismatch, and it all magically works, and you had no idea why. That's probably what scares me the most about writing code. I don't know if this is that big of a problem outside of the JavaScript ecosystem. Maybe I just signed up for this by learning to write JavaScript, but that's where I'm at.
Yeah, I think JavaScript's definitely one of the worst ecosystems when it comes to dependencies. Python's pretty bad, it's up there, but JavaScript isn't fun, that's for sure, especially when you're like trying to configure 17 different editor tools to all work together and like work on auto reload. Yeah, it can be a nightmare.
I'll drop a hot grenade right here. My ideal world is .NET on the front end and Blazor like actually becomes a real viable thing. But I don't know if that's happening anytime soon.
Tell me a little bit more. .NET on the front. So I'm familiar with .NET as a backend framework. So are you talking about like template rendering in .NET?
So Blazor is basically .NET's way of running, like building front end apps. And they like ship the entire .NET runtime in a WASM, in like WASM binaries. Which is, you can imagine if that's a great idea or not. I just don't think right now that's a great idea, but I would love to have that developer experience because .NET is just a fantastic language and ecosystem.
No. Get out of here with your Microsoft stack. I never would have invited you. No, I'm just kidding. So wait, I want to understand though. So Blazor is ships with like .NET applications, but it is a WASM powered like client side rendering engine?
Correct. Yeah, you can think of it as like a replacement to React or Angular or maybe something like Leptos if you're into Rust. Basically powering like client side interactions with WASM and not JavaScript, which is
it's gotta be
the
pretty
primary.
New, right?
Yeah, it's been around for a few years, I think. Steve Sanderson, one of the original guys who like created Knockout.js, another like JavaScript library, I think he works on it. And it's been around for a while. A lot of people use it. A lot of people who just don't want to write JavaScript, which is very understandable.
Yeah, super, super understandable. I've been wanting to use WASM on the front end for our listeners who aren't familiar. WASM just stands for WebAssembly. It's an acronym, but it's like an alternative to JavaScript for like doing execution on the front end. And it mostly works. It's gotten a lot better over the last few years. Sometimes the APIs aren't quite as nice, like the JavaScript APIs for doing DOM manipulations are obviously like pretty mature at this point. But what's interesting to me is, so is Blazor like, is it unique to C Sharp? Because you'd think a front end, like a client side library, like wouldn't really care what your back end is using to, you know, render the pages.
No, Blazor is very specifically .NET runtime or .NET code that can be compiled into WebAssembly.
Oh, okay.
Obviously a library like React, like with state management, event handlers to actually build your UI that can interact.
I was imagining like the React JavaScript library essentially just existing as a WASM binary, but that's not what's happening. You're actually writing C Sharp code that like compiles into WASM and then is used on the front end.
Yeah, like your on click handler for a button is written in C Sharp and it's running in WASM.
Interesting. I will probably never try it because it's C Sharp.
That's probably a good idea.
Maybe someday. I think the only way I get into C Sharp is via game development. I'm just way too happy with Go on the web. At the moment.
That's fair.
So, okay, so I made this like super offensive joke about DevRel's not writing code. To like circle around back to that though, a lot of people listening to this podcast might not even know what a DevRel is. Like, do you write code? How much code do you write? What are the other things that kind of go into being a DevRel?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And kind of, you're probably going to hate me for this, but it depends. So DevRel is kind of like really dependent on the kind of company it's working within, the kind of developers it's serving, like the developers that are the company's customers. So if you happen to use Clerk, you're a customer of Clerk. Or if you're interested in Clerk, you could be using Clerk, or you're interested in this space, you're interested in the product. As a DevRel, it's basically my job to look at this, like all of these people who might be interested in Clerk or who want to build better, more secure applications or build applications more easily with authentication, and do whatever kind of is needed, like provide education, provide support, get feedback from them, bring it back to the company, and whatever form that takes. So in my specific case, that ends up taking like content creation. So I find like product holes that are like really interesting features or really interesting use cases that people aren't really exploring or we haven't much talked about in their documentation or anything, and just like pump out blog posts or videos on top of them.
Got it. Blog post videos. That makes sense. It's almost like a product marketing role, at least for some of your time, I'm guessing.
Yeah. But it's driven by the needs of the community. So if I go into our support channels, if I talk to the people who are constantly like tweeting at Clerk Dev or at me, I look at like what are some of the things that people are requesting the most or people are struggling with the most. And then I write a blog post about that so that I can, next time someone asks me that question, like, hey, I wrote a blog post about this.
It is like a really interesting role in the sense that, so I've worked at companies where like we've had a marketing or a sales team, and then they'll have like a marketing engineer or a sales engineer, essentially like one of the engineers that doesn't mind hanging out with like in sales calls for whatever reason, because there are just certain companies, like Clerk obviously is one of them, where like you can't really sell or market the product unless you have a pretty deep understanding of the problems that the product's solving, which like tend to be technical problems in this case.
Exactly.
I'm guessing it's just like your day-to-day is wild. Like if you were to go be a DevRel at a different company, like your day-to-day would just be wildly different. Okay, cool. So Clerk is an auth company, and in this episode I really want to dive into a bunch of stuff surrounding authentication and authorization, so I don't think we've really touched that on the pod yet. Yeah, so let's start with like the idea of rolling your own auth. So we haven't talked about this on Twitter in a couple months, but it was a hot topic for a while, or a meme, basically. What do we mean when we say you should not roll your own auth?
Great question. The roll your own auth is kind of a huge spectrum. Like you can go from something as simple as I'm creating a sign-in route or a sign-up route that takes an email password and returns a JWT token, something like that. But if you look at the other side of the spectrum, you'll see that there are companies who are employing like 3 or 4 full-time engineers just to work on their kind of authentication identity servers that is used throughout the application, which probably means they're spending like over $1 million in just paying the salaries, paying the benefits, recruiting, hiring. And basically, there is a maintenance burden that comes with building anything, really. Like auth is just like any other part of your system. It's going to have some basic needs at the initial time, and its needs and its use cases are going to evolve over time. You're going to have to constantly add new things to it, add new features, fix bugs. And one of the biggest problems, which I'll probably get into later at some point, is that the auth tends to be a lot very decoupled to your existing system, which means it becomes even more difficult to maintain over time. So the idea of like outsourcing kind of undifferentiated things that you're doing, undifferentiated heavy lifting, is kind of a technical term that some people use. I just like to call it not reinventing the wheel. It's like every single software that you've ever built, that other people have built, that I've built, it has the same auth problems. It has the same auth solutions. Why are we spending a lot of time building this? And this has been around in the software industry forever. It has been around in manufacturing forever. If you go back to some books like Domain-Driven Design, where they talk about having generic subdomains and supporting subdomains. These are parts of your application that your business, your customers don't actually care about, or they kind of care about it, but it's nothing new. Like, that's not what separates you from your competitors. That's not the core problem you're trying to solve. So you should always try to delegate these responsibilities so that you can focus your entire engineering effort on providing value. And you should only really need to spend time on these other areas when, like, maybe the core thing that you're building, you've kind of hit a dead end there. There's not a lot of places to go, and you're trying to cut more costs now. I'm trying to not nerd snipe myself into talking about DHH, but yeah, that's kind of the core idea.
We'll have to get to DHH in a second. So, like, let me give an example, and you can tell me, like, correct me if I'm wrong. So when we talk about like undifferentiated work, so for example, boot dev, we have an interactive platform for learning backend development. And the thing that like differentiates us is like the features, the branding, the fun experience, and like the content. But what doesn't differentiate us is like credit card checkout. So we use Stripe for that. Like, we don't spend a lot of time building checkout systems because like we kind of just offload that to Stripe. Or we don't build and maintain our own SMTP servers to send our email notifications. We like offload that to SendGrid.
Or the video infrastructure. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, at the moment, we offload that to YouTube. But what I'm hearing is essentially what you're saying, like with rolling your own auth, is kind of the assertion that you're making, or that Clerk is making, is auth is another one of these like undifferentiated things. Like, you don't need to innovate on authentication for your web app. You need to innovate on your web app. So just use Clerk and do it quickly. It's kind of
That's basically what all auth providers kind of preach. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Pretty much.
I'm so excited for this conversation. Partly because, okay, so I've never rolled my own credit card system. Like, I've always used Stripe or some other third-party provider. I've actually never used an auth provider. I've always rolled my own auth. And just to quickly differentiate something that I don't know why this was even a discussion on Twitter, but like, I don't mean I rolled my own cryptography, right? Like, I'm of course using cryptographic libraries and stuff like that. But I've always like rolled my own either like username password thing or like magic links, like JWT thing. And I've never used a third party provider. So this should be a really fun conversation because I have some like pointed questions to hopefully try to figure out like what are the biggest pain points that could be solved by offloading authentication and authorization. To start, let's just like define some terms. So could you explain what the difference between authentication and authorization is?
Yeah, great question. The way I think about it, if you go to some like online blog posts, that they might have a different, more simplified definition of this, but the way I like to think about it is authentication is some sort of exchange of credentials or verification of credentials, something to do with I as a user want to do something and with your application, and I'm presenting a set of credentials along with my request. And now your application has to know what these credentials are and how to verify the request with these credentials. Authorization is the decision-making part. Anytime you look at the credentials, you look at the requests that I'm trying to make and make a decision either like if this should happen or not, or you filter a database query or any sort of a branching or if statement in your logic based on those credentials, I call that authorization. And everything else, the kind of token exchange, becomes authentication. That's how I define them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. To get like super hand wavy about it, what I'm hearing is like authentication is like I'm proving who I am. Like I'm Lane. If I can authenticate as Lane, then the system will kind of trust that I'm Lane. And you, like you said, usually that happens by like, you know, username, password, or token or whatever. And then like authorization is like, okay, once we know I'm Lane, like what is Lane allowed to do? Like, exactly. Well, Lane's allowed to upload a YouTube video to Lane's channel, but Lane's not allowed to upload a YouTube video to like Primogen's channel.
It's like, of course, yeah.
More like permission based. Is that the
So it can be anything, even if something as simple as you should not be able to see this page, or if you go to slash dashboard, you need to be signed in. That's that's the like the simple authorization rules. And I think a lot of times the conversation around authorization tends to get into those lots of role and permission heavy systems, which is like, obviously it's one extreme, like an authorization system will get there at some point if your use case gets complex enough. But even the simple things like these are the public routes of my application, these are the private routes, and you need to be signed in to get there because I have the middleware. I also call that authorization.
Yeah, that makes complete sense to me. So which is the bigger pain point for most companies, authentication or authorization?
I'm going to bring back my old friend. It depends. Now, let me explain this one.
I hate him. He's a fucking asshole.
If you all do. So both are, I'll say both can be simple or difficult problems. The difference is that they're like, they're different kinds of problems. You need different approaches to solve both of them. So authorization, I look at that as kind of a fundamental modeling problem, which is that you have a certain use case of your application. You need to like look at the different interaction points, the different things the user can do, and kind of like make it fit your, for lack of a better word, org structure, or the like the mental structure, how you think about what are the different users, what are they allowed to do, and create a mapping between it. This is like a very high level way to describe it. But again, it can be as simple as this is a protected route. And it can be as simple as I have a user ID column in my posts or comments table, right? So which means every like every comment I post, it's tagged with my user ID. Only I'm allowed to edit it. Only I'm allowed to delete it, maybe something like that.
Right.
And then like as your use case evolves, your authorization has to evolve with it. So you now have, you'll have permissions. You might have like, okay, I need to be in this specific location at this time to be able to access this. Or if I'm not able to access that, I can request a permission from my boss. You can click a button and says, yes, share access. And now I can see it. And maybe in after an hour, the access gets revoked again. So all of these, like it becomes a lot about how we model real world interactions into our application. So this is going to be something you'll struggle with if you don't understand your use case well enough, if you are not able to represent those real world business or policies in your application. So that's the authorization part. Any questions so far?
I mean, it's sounding to me already like that is that like can be extremely hairy, but let's move on to authentication before we do compare and contrast.
Yeah. So the fun part about authentication is that it's not a modeling problem. It's a distributed systems problem, which means now you're dealing with different like multiple clients across or clients or servers that sit like in a network that talk over unsecure or secure protocols. And now you're dealing with standards, you're dealing with schemas, you're dealing with cryptography, obviously, like token signing, validation, or password hashing, things like these. You're dealing with cash invalidation, probably, where you have like a token is kind of a cash. You send a token with a lifetime, and if it expires, the client has to get a new token, or you have your session cache somewhere in your Redis. So with authentication, now you no longer have to understand your use case because authentication looks the same for every application, right? Almost. But now you have these distributed systems problem of what are the different protocols that I'm dealing with? How am I representing them? How am I making sure that this credential is secure? Or where else do I need to go to fetch some information, fetch some permissions about this user to make a decision. I know that's I call that authorization. But before you can do authorization, you need to have you need to have what the permissions are. Either they're in your token or you need to reach out to an external database for it, right? Again, now this is something that you'll struggle with if you have a difficulty kind of like grasping a lot of this technical complexity and a bunch of moving parts across different servers or different clients. Or, but that's also why this is kind of this has a lot of specifications, a lot of like pre-built libraries and guidelines on how to do it, because it's undifferentiated and because it kind of looks the same everywhere.
So my initial perception, and this isn't just a perception, this is also embedded in some of my experience, but it seems to me that if you have a very simple web app where you're not doing like cross user permissions, it's kind of like you log in as a user, you can kind of do your own thing and like log out. And especially if you're rolling your own authentication and authorization, then authentication is probably the like harder problem. Because you're just not doing very much with permissions yet. It's a very simple, just like, can you log in? Great. You can do everything regarding your, like, can do everything in relation to your own account and log out. It seems to me that as the, like, as the use case grows, and in particular regarding, like, what you're allowed to do and protected resources and, like, sharing across groups, it seems to me that authorization quickly becomes the much hairier problem.
Yeah, and that's how we end up with things like Google Zanzibar or like any of these super complex permission systems.
It's kind of like Active Directory in Microsoft, right?
Exactly. Yes. Active Directory in Microsoft, that's one big example of this. And again, like Active Directory kind of was born out of this, like multiple users can sign into the same computer. That's why it exists.
Right. Like that makes perfect sense to me. So now, like, when we talk about like rolling your own versus not rolling your own. So I've thought a little bit about this. And like I said, full disclosure, never used a third party other than like I've set up, you know, sign in with GitHub or sign in with Google. I've set up like third party authentication, but I've never used a product like Clerk.
I've rolled my own auth for like 3+ years.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to me that authentication would be really easy. Like it would be easy to convince me to use something like Clerk for authentication because it's like, I just want my users to be able to sign in. You know what I mean? And I just want to know who they are. So like if I can use a product that just gives me a nice sign in form with like several options and like handles the emails and the tokens, like that makes sense to me. Where it gets hairy in my mind is using a third party product again for authorization. Is that, is my gut right in feeling that way or am I way off?
So no, you're definitely very right on that. So this is why it took Clerk kind of like a very, very long time to release kind of like a custom roles and permissions feature. Because exactly like you said, it's really hard to draw that boundary between what can a generic service like Clerk offer in terms of authorization, which is fundamentally such a modeling use case driven problem, right? And that's what all authorization systems struggle with, which is why we have 5,000 of them. We have RBAC, ABAC, I don't know how many different there are now. But kind of over time, with services like Google and GitHub getting really, really big and having to figure out all of this, where because they have like huge teams that work across different use cases, and they want to be able to like make the life of all those teams easier. They worked a lot on making kind of some of these like universal authorization systems, like basically figuring out that where that boundary should be, where a generic service can help you, but you can still adopt it for whatever use case you have. Right. And this ends up just as like roles and permissions, and you can create your own roles out of permissions. So basically secure everything with a permission. And it's completely your decision on what the permission should be called, who this permission should be given to. You just secure like a single interaction, like the smallest interaction that you can secure with a permission. And then you give that permission to whoever you want. You can structure your roles however you want. You can put them in whatever category. But then if you have to go beyond that, for example, GitHub has repositories, that's something that you'll have to implement yourself.
Does everyone use Clerk for both authentication and authorization? Or are there a lot of companies that are mostly just using it for authentication and then like do most of the authorization stuff on their own application servers?
Yeah, great question. As of the time of recording this, we have very recently released our like custom roles and permissions feature. So as of right now, probably no one is using that feature, or like obviously some people might be in like beta or behind feature flags, but most Clerk users are not using the custom roles and permissions that we just launched. That said, because of the way Clerk kind of does session management, it's really useful to use Clerk for like storing the authorization data so that it's like always there in the token. So with the session management, whenever you get a request with a token from a client, it has all the, like you can have just all the authorization data that you need in that token. So you never need to make an additional call to the database to like, hey, what are the permissions for this user? Or what subscription plan is this user on so that I can calculate credits. All of that information can just be in the token. So you can use that permissions like to authorize however you want, but just to store those permissions somewhere in the session, that's the part that Clerk takes care of. And it avoids the need to having to wire all of the permissions up wherever they're needed in your application.
Okay, so I want to recap that to make sure that everyone kind of understands what we're talking about. So when you say token, are you typically talking about like a JWT?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So for those of our listeners who don't understand or haven't encountered JWTs yet, a JWT is basically a token that a user is given kind of behind the scenes, right? Usually in the code of like the front end. So their front end device kind of has access to this token, and the token authenticates them, right? Like they're the only ones with the token. It's kind of just by nature of owning the token, the backend system is going to trust that this person is who they say they are because they like already authenticated previously. And when we're talking about storing permissions in the token versus in the database, it's common for applications to have like some database table that it like maps a user to all the things they're allowed to do. Like, is this user allowed to post videos? Are they allowed to read videos, right? And there's kind of just like all these sometimes flags or sometimes enums in a database that like represent a user's permissions. And if I'm understanding correctly, what you're saying, Dev, is, well, our authorization system will typically just embed those permissions right in the token. So like the token gets a little larger. JWT stands for JSON Web Token. It's essentially a big JSON object. But you can embed them right in there so that now when the backend system grabs the token in an HTTP request, it doesn't need to like go round trip to the database and say, hey, what are these users' permissions? You can just like check them right there.
Yeah, and this is also a very key kind of unlocker for running authenticated servers on the edge. So now, like up until now, the use cases for like edge servers were kind of like just do a little customization or local stuff for like close to the users. But now that you can also fully authenticate requests on an edge server without having to reach to a database, you can do a lot more on edge. And I'm going to be writing more on this topic very soon.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about that. Okay, so the boot dev backend currently works based on JWTs as well. But I've noticed that the problem for me in most of my handlers on our backend server is that I take the JWT and I check that it's valid and that, you know, the authentication signatures and everything match. But then after that, I have a user ID. And generally speaking, the permissions part, I would say it's usually like not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is usually that I have to join my user's table to like a bunch of other tables. And so my question is, when you use a service like Clerk, does your user's table effectively live in like an outside system, like in Clerk's API that I would have to like make network requests to? Or do I typically also have like my user data stored in my application? And is there like syncing issues? Like basically just how does that whole thing work?
Yeah, great question. So yes, when you're going to use an auth provider, your source of truth of your user data, session data, whatever other thing you have, organizations, they're going to live with the auth provider. So Clerk will maintain your users, your organization, sessions, table, everything. And so one of the things about like having to join frequently with the users table, what often happens when we start rolling our own auth is that we develop our auth features as they are needed in the application. We don't just like sit down for like a month and say, let's get all the authentication features out of the way, and then let's continue working on the app, right? You implement some basic features, you work on the rest of the app. then as you need a couple more things, you develop more more parts of your auth, like you add maybe permissions, you add some more session management, and then you go on. This often leads to, as I mentioned earlier, the auth being kind of coupled to the rest of your system. So when you're often joining with the users table, the first thing I say there is that that might be a symptom of like you've maybe overly coupled the two systems and maybe you need to better separate them. But that's also like kind of my issue with joins in usual. And then obviously once you hit the apps, the actual legitimate use cases where you want to join the users table, cool. You can just set up a webhook listener and now you have all the user session data in your own database and you can join them with as much like wherever you want. You can do transactions so that you can make sure the user is in a specific state before you do something, anything like that. And this is done through a webhook listener. So it will get updated in real time pretty much. Like it'll basically almost always be in sync. The only kind of like very small edge case there is that like, let's say I sign up and then I immediately try to go to dashboard, but the webhook hasn't hit your database yet. So your application doesn't know I'm a real user. And in which cases you can usually just show them just another like loading spinner for a few more seconds, retry, and you're all good. You can do that with webhooks. The other way to do this is something called a Postgres foreign data wrapper, FDW. It's specific to Postgres. It basically makes creates a facade of a table, but behind the scenes, it's talking to an external server using API requests. There is a foreign data wrapper for Clerk that if you have a Postgres database, you can use that and you can just have your users table. Now, obviously, you lose a little bit of efficiency in terms of like your data is not all there. Whenever you joined, you're now making an additional API request, but you no longer have to deal with like syncing data and making sure you didn't miss any updates with webhooks. So there's both options there. Both have kind of their own trade-offs. And they both kind of achieve the same thing that you wanted to achieve, which is being able to join the users table.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I've worked in a lot of microservices environments. In fact, pretty much my whole career has been microservices and varying I'm degrees sorry. Of microservices. Yeah, exactly. It's distributed systems are fun or hell. They're fun hell. It's always different, though. Every company like draws boundaries between services in different ways. And typically, when we say microservices, like one of the defining features of a microservice is that individual microservices typically don't share a database.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's possible that they can, but like, and there's like a lot of different philosophies about this, but like for the example I'm giving, they don't, right? And one problem that we ran into at one of the companies I was at was that essentially we made the user's service its own service. And really the only thing that was in the user service was like users and organizations. So just like authentication, authorization, users, and like how we group users together. And it was a constant pain point because in order to do any sort of join, you're doing it across the network, which means like rather than taking, you know, let's just like use the example of a social media application, instead of getting like 20 users and their posts for today, like you can't do that in a join. So first you have to go get 20, you have to go get like, I mean, I guess you could start with the users. So you could like go to the user service and get the 20 users, and then you'd have to go to the other service and like do a SQL query with like the 20 IDs. Or you could start with the posts and then go across the network to the user service. But the point is you're not able to, in the SQL query, join everything up and pull it out. And sometimes it can kill the performance of the query, right?
Not sometimes. It always kills the performance. It's just, did you notice it? Or did the users notice it?
Yeah, well, it's like, sometimes it's like just an extra network round trip, which like is fine. Like, that's not a problem.
Yeah.
But sometimes it like takes a query that would have been like, you know, order n of one and like makes it n of n or something. Like you have to do like some iterative querying or something. Is that one of the biggest pain points with moving your users out to a third party service like Clerk? Or is it just not actually that big of a deal once you know how to deal with it?
I mean, I don't see why both of those cannot be true. If you know how to deal with it, obviously it's not a pain. If you don't know how to deal with it, it's a pain. So how much do you know about CQRS, command query responsibility segregation?
Like assume nothing. Idea. I've heard the acronym, but okay. I really don't know much about it.
So basically what I described earlier, where the source of truth of user data still lives within Clerk, because that's kind of the microservice that owns the authorization piece. But while that is the source of truth, you can easily replicate that data wherever you want, as long as it's a read-only replica. And you can even you don't have to replicate the entire user table. Maybe you just need the name and email, ID and image. Maybe you just need those four fields. But the idea is that wherever you want to join with this data, just like set up a listener and build your own replica of it. So that because joining across the network is a lot more expensive than storing a little bit more data just wherever you are. And you still have that separation because you're not making changes to the replica. If you want to make any changes to it, you still go to the main service. So it's basically taking that read-write replica model of database. It's how we scale databases, but taking that to microservices where the source of truth lives in one place, but any other service that wants to join with it can just have a replica of it. And that's what webhooks enable us to do. Obviously, in internal systems, you can just have like something like RabbitMQ or change detection, Kafka, whatever you have in that case. Or maybe you don't even... Ideally, the first thing I would actually say there is don't do microservices as long as you can. I have a video. One of my biggest videos on my YouTube channel is called Stop Building Microservices. But once you're already there, you've already accepted eventual consistency. You're already dealing with distributed architecture. So just replicate that data and don't do the join. Storing data is much cheaper than making network hops.
Yeah. I'm sure you touch on this nuance in your video, but microservices were really hot like 7 years ago, right? Like 2017, mm-hmm. 2018. Like it was mm-hmm. the super hot thing to do. You're going to be able to scale infinitely if you do microservices. And like way too many companies did microservices. And I've worked at both companies that did microservices and mm-hmm. shouldn't have, or maybe should have done fewer. So like maybe they had 10 mm-hmm. microservices and they should have had 3, and companies that absolutely needed them. So I definitely would not prescribe don't do microservices, because there comes a point where you can literally save millions of dollars if you're mm-hmm. not just like scaling a Ruby monolith to, you mm-hmm. know, 5,000 replicas.
Yeah, I'm just assuming if you're working at that large scale companies, you're not watching my videos. you're watching boot.dev. You're not watching me.
This is actually interesting. Like the companies I worked at, some mm-hmm. they were like medium-sized companies. But the scale mm-hmm. of data we were working with was often fairly large. Like we were doing analysis on social media data. It's like slurping in the Twitter fire hose or something like that. Mm-hmm. But the companies weren't necessarily very large themselves. What's mm-hmm. like the average size company that like uses Clerk? Is it startups? Is it enterprise?
I'm not sure like how much I'm supposed to talk about here. but like most
spill
of
the,
them are
spill the beans.
Yeah, most of our customers are certainly the like small to medium scale projects that really want to focus on both like have a good quality authentication system that they never have to worry about, that kind of like just upgrades their app with security and user experience features because they want to build like a nice user experience. And again, Clerk is primarily a front end first tool. So if like you're going to use Clerk if you really want to build a nice front end, offer
we don't
that
care
better,
about
nice user
people
experience.
Who like front end here. They're not. Are they even developers, really?
Probably. Yeah, that's all right, that's a fine. Can of worms I'm not going to touch. I've already brought up Blazor and DHH in here, and we've talked about rolling here or not. I'll leave the front end conversation for some other time.
fair enough. Okay, but that makes sense to mm-hmm. me. I mean, like, you could even argue, like, Stripe, mm-hmm. basically any tool... Any mm-hmm. developer tool service, like a Stripe mm-hmm. or a Clerk or a SendGrid, mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. probably targeting smaller companies. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they grow with the company, but sometimes mm-hmm. the company outgrows the service. But I would imagine mm-hmm. in almost all cases, it makes most sense for smaller companies because you just don't have the resources to roll your own, even mm-hmm. if you wanted to.
There's both sides there because we are definitely also trying for enterprise customers. And actually, one of the biggest ways to do anything for enterprise customers is just say, hey, we solved SAML for you. And they're going to, oh, let's go.
Yeah, yeah. That's all enterprise ever wants, in my experience, is SAML.
One of the ways that we also like help enterprise customers or like smaller teams within an existing enterprise easily build applications or front ends that they want, is that Clerk just sits in front of a SAMLOT server and you can just use Clerk normally. You don't have to deal with SAML at all. And any existing SAML users that your organization has can just simply sign in to Clerk and sign in using Clerk to your application. And you never have to worry about that. And obviously, custom roles and permissions is another part of that, where we want some of these complex like B2B products to be able to use Clerk and take full advantage of everything that we are offering, from the pre-built components to the built-in session management. And with this, like all the permissions are in your token. You don't have to make additional requests for it.
Okay, very cool. I have a question. This one's more of just like a curiosity. I don't know if you have the data on hand, but maybe you have like a kind of a ballpark. I'm guessing Clerk provides like passwords, sign in with Google, sign in with GitHub, probably like a bunch of different providers. Do you do magic links as well, or just passwords?
Yeah.
Magic links as well.
Magic links, one-time passwords, time-based OTP, so like mobile Microsoft Authenticator, apps like that, everything.
What are the most common ones? So like when a website spins up their authentication form, what do people actually use to sign in?
Over half of all Clerk signups happen through Google. That's like easily the most dominant way to sign into any application. And also like one of the easiest ways to verify an email. So think of like all the email verification links or magic or like codes that are saved through Google. So that's easily the biggest way to like the largest, and specifically Google. I'm not even just talking about OAuth in general, just Google.
Right. Just Google.
Yeah. Because everyone enables it and everyone has it.
What are the next two or three?
I don't really know the answer to that question. It can be like pretty much anything. But yeah, we support everything from links to codes to like really advanced passwords. Passwords are like one of those things where I'm sure the entire web would be really grateful if we never had to deal with passwords ever again. And a lot of different different people and different projects within auth, different libraries and providers, they have like taken various stances towards passwords. Some say that, no, we won't support passwords at all. If you like, we think passwordless is the future. And if you're building an application, you shouldn't use passwords. That's a stance some people take personally. And even both for Clerk, like there is a legitimate use case for passwords. I've been building some applications for the last 3 years that just needed a password because of the kind of regulation and organizational environment they live in.
I dropped my passwords table about a year and a half ago. It was one of the most satisfying. Yeah, it was one of the most satisfying feelings I've ever had. Just seeing all those hashes disappear into the aether. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I found was that 80% of our users sign in with Google, 10 to 15% sign in with GitHub, and the other 5% are fine with using magic links. And so, I mean, at the end of the day, like a magic link is, for first time sign up, less cumbersome than a password, because if you do a password, you still have to go verify 100%. Your email. Whereas with a magic link, you don't. So anyways, it was, at least for my use case, it was so nice to get rid of passwords, but I can see how there's maybe cases where you can't do that.
So that's why Clerk kind of like, I think recently this year in May, like we really improved the entire password experience with both like reset password, forgot password, all of those flows, as well as giving kind of giving like you as a developer like a much more control over the password rules. Like how complex do you want them to be? Do you want them to be checked for breaches? So like even the people who use passwords, not all of them use password managers. If they did, our life would be a lot easier in terms of like we don't have to implement a bunch of confirm password or make sure it's secure, make sure it's this length, but we still have to do that. And again, some organizations, they're going to force their users to do a password and define all those complexity rules just because they want to, just because that's how they've done it. So all of those features are now built into Clerk.
As a user of the internet now, I sign up with like Google is my go-to, GitHub is my backup. If I can't sign in with Google or GitHub, then I will use a password if that's what the website uses. But I will never, I always generate unique passwords and save them in a password manager. And that's just how I internet these days.
Even auth providers, I'm sure, would be much happier if all of us did that.
Yeah, it takes like a bit of a mental switch. Like I remember like as a kid, as an early teenager on the internet, I, like so many other people, just like use the same password for literally everything, right? And that work. Oh shit. We're gonna have to cut that out. You're gonna get fired. I got pwned like one too many times. It was never anything serious, but like, you know, I got some random account hacked or whatever. And it's not fun. So I just don't do it anymore. And like, you don't need to go pay for a password manager necessarily. Like if you have like really specific use cases, you might need to go find a paid product. But like, I just use Chrome's built-in password manager. And like, it's certainly not the it's certainly not the most wonderful UI. It actually is probably competing for one of the worst UIs, but it does get the job done, and it is better than remembering all my passwords. So
yeah, here we are. And they recently brought in some more security features. Like, I have to use my Windows PIN or my Mac like touch bar before it allows it autofills a password. So now it's I hope. That also means that it's storing those passwords securely instead of...
I think
of,
it must be encrypting them. Otherwise, like, why would it do that, right? Like, admitting that I use Chrome sometimes online feels like... And I am not a Windows developer, so, like, you can't accuse me of that. But, like, it feels like when I was in college and developing on Windows, it was, like, that same kind of admission. Like, oh, I develop on Windows. Like, oh, I use Chrome as my browser.
You just feel guilty doing it.
Yeah. Internally. Like, real developers use, I don't even know what they use. They use Firefox these days. Probably something super cool.
Brave. Oh, no, not Brave. Arc. Arc. Yeah, that's the new hotness.
Heard of Arc. There's another one that I've heard of that's like really small and niche. That's like a fork of Firefox. I don't know. I'm not that
maybe hit. Opera GX, which is like one of the gamer ones.
Yeah. I'm not an Arch user, so I'm actually okay just using Chrome for now. Okay, cool. We've gotten through a lot of the questions that I wanted to talk about. This has been a lot of fun. I have a couple more, though. One is just, again, like a curiosity. Sign in with Google does not work the same way that like sign in with GitHub or sign in with Twitter works. There's no, like, at least to the user, no like visible redirection happening. Sometimes you just like click a button and then like sign in. How do they do that? Like, how the hell does that work? Is that OAuth? Is there even a redirect involved?
Yeah. Oh boy, we're talking about OAuth. Right. So OAuth kind of originally, it was developed as a way for services like Google or GitHub or like those big applications for like people to build their own applications and have access to the data that's within Google and like do whatever they want with it. Right. That was kind of the original use case for OAuth, that instead of signing in directly to our application, you can have any other server or application sign in and have access to the data. But obviously over time, this evolved into, hey, if you can just sign in with Google, I know you're a legit user. You don't need to create a password with me and I don't need to verify your email, things like that. So that became a much larger use case of OAuth. And then obviously it became a pain because OAuth was not intended for this use case. So now that you're trying to build this, just an identity server, like just use Google as identity instead of for like actual data, you still have to jump through all the hoops of how to connect to an OAuth server, and everyone has their own ways of doing it, right? The OIDC protocol or Open ID Connect protocol, that was kind of developed as a way to let's make OAuth for identity very easy to use and just like ignore everything else about OAuth, ignore that we can also get data from there. Just use it as identity and then build a lot of standards and basically build standards on top of OAuth protocol for like even more specific.
It sounds like it's like a stripping down, like it's trying to remove a bunch of use cases and friction so that it's easier just to do the identity piece. Is that?
Yeah. Removing as in like, it's still using that exact same technology under the hood. It's just more standards on top of it. Like this is one URL that you need to call. You don't need to deal with maybe scopes and stuff. And the way OIDC works is that if you're using Google, you're going to go to Google, get your client ID, client secret, whatever. And then your application can just redirect you to Google with those two credentials, or at least with just the application ID. the user is going to come back to your application with some sort of a code or some sort of a token. And now you can use this token to fetch, to like get the user data from the server, from the Google server. So that really like simplifies this entire flow, which is why sometimes you can just click a button and you're signed in. Because there's also some like consent steps that obviously happen behind the screen. Like not behind the screen, but when you get redirected to Google, you have to make sure you're consenting to the application. You have their privacy policy and everything. But once you've done all of that, Google can just like give you back a token. And again, we're talking about like exchange of credentials. So Google gives you a token, which you give to the application, and then the application uses it to get other tokens, which have the user ID.
Yeah.
Does that kind of help it?
Yeah, absolutely. As someone who rolled the auth for for boot dev in like the V1 of boot dev, we had sign in with Google, sign in with GitHub, and sign in with Twitter. I've since dropped Twitter.
I can imagine why.
Yeah. Twitter was the fucking worst. It used OAuth 1, which is like, first of all, is crazy. You've got like, I can't even remember all the names, but like you've got like the consumer key and the consumer secret and the token key and the token secret. And you need like all four pieces of information. You send them off to the server and then they send you back some stuff. And like you have to hash it in just the right way and like do some signing. And it's crazy and it's awful and just to get like signed in. And I got it working and everything, but like just such a fucking pain. I believe GitHub uses OAuth 2. If I remember correctly.
Pretty much everyone, pretty much any sensible or popular, popularly used service uses OAuth 2, and more specifically OIDC as well on top of it. So you can use it, obviously, that just as I like give access to my depositories, which is what OAuth is used for, or just if you want sign in with GitHub, then you're using the OIDC provider, which is like, so all of these kind of providers have agreed to the OIDC standard, which means they all have like very similar endpoints, very similar kind of guarantees and behaviors, so that the code that we have to write to interface with it, it has become like mostly the same, which is why now like libraries like Auth.js or like whatever Lucia, whatever like open source library or even auth provider that you'll be using, we have to do much less work to interface with all the different OIDC providers because they all look almost the same. Almost. I can go on a different rant about this as well.
Well, so Twitter was awful. We've dropped it. GitHub uses OAuth 2. That was like, that's fine. The fascinating thing though is how Google works, and I almost wonder if this is only possible because like Chrome or something, to be honest. I guess that doesn't make sense because people can sign in with other browsers. Anyways, the point I'm getting to is they give you like a JavaScript client library, and when the user interacts with it, it just like calls back with a token. So you just like get this JWT from Google, and then you can ship that up to your backend server and like validate it and everything. That was fascinating to me. You haven't used that one?
No, I don't think I'm familiar with this.
It's pretty interesting. Unless I'm like totally making things up. Do you know how embarrassing that would be?
No, that does sound possible. Like for example, Google Chrome has this now where if you go to an application and it sees that it uses sign in with Google, it just shows you all the Chrome profiles that you're signed or all the Google accounts that you've signed into, and you can just click a button and be signed in. So I can definitely imagine that they've done this.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm looking at I'm going from memory here. So forgive me if I get some details wrong, but I'm on the like sign in with Google docs and like the second heading down, it says compare to Auth and OpenID Connect. In other words, they're not sign with Google is based on OAuth 2.0. The permissions users granted through sign with Google are the same as those they would grant for OAuth. So it's not actually using OAuth. And if I'm remembering correctly, this is basically how it works. And the interesting thing was, as a developer, you'd like write a little bit snippet of front-end code or like import a JavaScript library. And upon callback, so like upon the user finishing their authentication, which oftentimes is just like clicking the sign in with Google button, it like gives you a token that's signed by Google. And all you have to do is ship that up to your backend and like check the token signature. and it'll have like an ID and an email in it. And to me, that was like by far the easiest from like an authentication developer standpoint. Yeah. And I don't know why more companies aren't doing it this way.
So I think like this kind of, I guess, bypasses the redirect mechanism where you don't have to redirect to some other page and then have handle callback and then like know which query parameter the token is going to be in so that you can handle it. So this looks like it's just kind of like bypassing that. And instead of sending a whole redirect, it does something else to just get the token in like in the same process without having to redirect or handle a separate route. That definitely seems like it solves a lot of this OAuth redirect use cases problems. But I don't know how specific that is to Google and how easily others can implement that.
Yeah, because I have not looked into it enough to speak intelligently about it. I know from like the user experience, it was great as a developer, but like just immediately a few things come to mind. Like, okay, hold on. I'm using Google's JavaScript library and they're like rendering a login form and the user's typing in their password there. So my website is gaining access to the user's Google password. Now, maybe there's some security stuff going on. Like, I don't know if it's maybe in an iframe or something. Like, maybe it is locked down so that I can't actually get access to their Google password. I would imagine that has to be the case, right?
And that's a very easy way to get reported for phishing.
Right?
Like, I feel like.
Yeah. But, like, I feel like Google wouldn't allow that, right?
I'll have to look more into it. But, yeah, this definitely sounds interesting.
Because, like, I would be able to hack if I wanted to. Because, like, the whole point of OAuth is, like, Google wants to allow individual websites to have their users authenticate through Google. But they don't want all of these websites to be able to, like, if they're malicious, steal Google users' credentials. Like, that's crazy.
Exactly, yeah.
So there's got to be some sort almost of security certainly, mechanism in place.
Yeah, they're almost certainly doing it, like, within some sort of an iframe or maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll have to look more into it.
Because like that is the purpose of the redirect mechanism in OAuth, right? Is like we're going to send you to their server and that way we're going to send you to the auth provider's server. That way the application cannot get access to like raw passwords or whatever.
Correct. Yeah.
Anyways, maybe we'll have to do a follow-up episode like next year and talk more about how the hell Google accomplishes this because it is very interesting. I think it's probably an iframe thing.
So you want to, will next year, do you have, will you have this podcast renamed to Frontend Banter so that we can talk about frontend stuff then?
Authentication, authorization, this is backend stuff. Frontend developers just like slap HTML on pages. Like, come on.
Yeah, I thought we were talking about iframes. That sounds like HTML.
Stop questioning the scope of my podcast, Dev.
Got it. Okay. My bad for overstepping there.
Okay, cool. Final question. What's your most unpopular opinion about web architecture that deals with authentication and authorization? What's everyone doing wrong?
Oof, that's a loaded question, specifically about authorization and authentication. I think this might be what we talked earlier about putting permissions and putting more information in the JWT, in the token that we use for authentication. I haven't seen a lot of people talk about the benefits of this. That's how Clerk works. That's how I've been like kind of investigating or like whenever I'm kind of playing around with auth or ideas or like comparing different auth systems. This is one of the things that I look at quite often is, am I having to reach out to a different server, to a different database to like make decisions, to do authorization, to get permissions or get whatever plan the user is on, what feature flags they have enabled. And this sort of like token session management, another very important piece here is short-lived tokens, which means the tokens that we use for authorization, for authentication are only valid for a minute, which means the client is responsible for keeping it refreshed. And this is kind of what allows us to still have like completely stateless token authentication where we don't have to reach out to a server, but still be able to do remotely sign out of device, or here's how long, or inactivity timers, or like requesting access and immediately getting that access and like dynamic permissions basically. I think this is like a heavily underrated way to do session management that a lot more people can be taking advantage of, and basically giving this like easy way to build a lot of auth capabilities, like this remote sign out, and also not like solve kind of the infrastructure complexity of having a bunch of session, like a Redis cache for sessions, or like bombing your database with a bunch of like get permissions queries every time you receive a request.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know how really good point popular that is.
No, this is a good point. I don't know how unpopular it is either. I think you're right to say, though, that most people aren't doing what you're describing, which is like using JWTs for auth. Already, that's not like the most popular thing ever. It's probably more popular now than it was, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. But then using like extremely short like token live times of like 1 minute. So I want to like say back to you what you just said to me, make sure everybody is on the same page. So there's basically two ways to do authentication. And I'm sure there's more, but there's like two primary ways that people actually do it. The first is like session-based authentication. And the second is like stateless. So session based, of course, is stateful, stateless is stateless. And the difference is in the kind of the session based version, the backend is keeping track of who's logged in. So at any time, a developer or an admin or whatever can go look in the database and see, oh, look, we have like 47 logged in users right now. And if for whatever reason, you determine that one of those people gained access maliciously, you can like go into your database and delete a record to like sign them out.
Yep.
Or like you can imagine Netflix, they have a button like sign out on all devices or whatever. You just like kill it, kill those devices, sessions. Stateless management is really nice because there's nothing in the database, which means you don't have to check the database every time you want to see if somebody's logged in. So it's like from a software architecture perspective, stateless is awesome. It's like less code, it's less networking, it's less overhead, like all these nice things. But the big problem is you're giving out these tokens that have a time to live. Let's say it's like an hour. If you want to sign out that user, you can stop them from getting new tokens, but you can't really stop them from using the token they already have. Like they're going to be able to use it for a whole nother hour to like do bad things. So what I'm hearing from you is we actually like the stateless way, but to get around the problem, we'll just set like super low time to lives. So it's like your token only works for a minute. Now, immediately, of course, you're thinking in your head, wait, but I'm going to be logged into this thing for a long time. I don't want to re-log in every minute. Well, what you're saying is the code on the front end is just going to continuously refresh that token like very quickly. Am I understanding correctly?
Yeah. So, yeah, that was a great description of like what are the two different ways of doing things. The short-lived tokens, yes. So exactly as you described, the client has to constantly refresh the token. You can make that interval really, really small if you want a lot of security. Clerk kind of goes with 1 minute. I think it's a good trade-off. And it's a hybrid model of both. So we are still keeping track of sessions on the server because that's how we refresh the tokens. But we only use that to refresh the tokens, not to constantly reach back out to check authentication. So basically, you know, earlier I said a JWT is just a cache. We're using the token as like a 1 minute cache of what the sessions table is.
Well, you would normally be caching stuff in like a Redis, in-memory data store. You're just doing it in the token. Seems cool to me. The only potential downside I really see is, I mean, there's obviously the potential downside of you do have to wait a full minute. That's not very long, but you do have to wait like a full minute to like invalidate someone's session, if I'm understanding properly.
Yeah. So a full minute basically means that a maximum of full minutes. So for example, let's say you somehow got access to my account. And if I notice that and if I remotely sign out, if you just refreshed your token, if your application just refreshed your token right before I remotely signed out, you're going to have less than a minute to continue using my application.
Right.
But more often than not, it's going to be like a lot less than a minute. Or maybe if you're not looking at the application right now, the next time you open the application, it'll try to refresh the token. It won't be there and you won't have access. So the minute is like the maximum amount of time.
Right.
More often than not, it's going to be much smaller, much shorter than that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like that's one potential like small little thing. The only other thing that comes to my mind is like potentially bandwidth, because you have to constantly be making network requests to update the token. Has that ever been a problem, or has it just mostly been negligible?
I mean, it's a trade-off, right? Are you eating the bandwidth of constantly checking your database, or are you eating the bandwidth of checking of making that network request once a minute, right?
Per user. So the database would
and,
be
and it's also once a minute when they're actively using your app. If they obviously close the tab, you're not doing anything, right?
Right. The bandwidth to the server would have been in the other scenario would be the bandwidth between the backend server and the database, mm-hmm. which very often mm-hmm. is like an internal backend network. So like latency mm-hmm. is really small and like the user doesn't even yeah. really see that. Whereas this is actually like yeah. latency across the internet from the mm-hmm. user to the backend server. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that.
Yeah. So in that case, it's the quantity. So if I'm using your application for a few minutes, the token refresh is going to happen once every minute, but the client server interactions, like whenever I'm clicking on a button or navigating around or fetching some data, that's going to happen multiple times, maybe like a few requests in a second, or like that's definitely not going to be once a minute, right? That's going to be a lot more. And for each of those requests, you are connecting from the server to the database or a cache to get this additional information. So you right. either have like one client server additional request, or like potentially 500 or like a couple hundred server to database requests.
No, it sounds like to me they're not big drawbacks. They're just something to keep in mind. Like mm-hmm. that is a thing adding to your architecture. Cool. This has been an amazing episode, honestly. And I'm really glad we were able to cover kind of sessions and tokens. I think that's new ground for a lot of people. Before we wrap up, where can people find mm-hmm. you online, and where can they find Clerk if they're interested in learning more?
Yeah, you can find me on YouTube. If you search at DevAGR, I have a YouTube channel where I make videos on architecture, on design, on software, web in general, and also on Twitter, where I'm usually a lot more active. So I think this should be you should have probably my Twitter username somewhere around here. You can follow me on Twitter, and Clerk is obviously on clerk.com.
Clerk.com. Okay, cool. I'll drop all those links down in the description and in the show notes. Thanks again for coming on, man. We'll talk to you later.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been fun.